This is Wade Rathke, and it's Wade's World. You know what that means. It's Friday morning, 9 sharp. We're on KABF 88.3 FM on your dial, 100,000 watts of people power, broadcasting from Little Rock, Arkansas, live streaming at www.kabf.org, and available on podcast by Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today, we're talking to Kim Bobo in Chicago, Executive Director of Interfaith Worker Justice. Kim, welcome to Wade's World.
Hey, thank you, Wade.
Yeah, it's a wild one. So Interfaith Workers Justice, it's been going for quite a while. What, 1996, something like that?
That's right, 18 years.
Well, who's counting? So give us a little sense of what y'all do with IWJ. I know it's all over the country.
Yeah, well, we were really started with the mission of engaging the faith community in labor issues. And I think initially we viewed that primarily as working to support workers' rights to organize and be in unions and working on public policies that raise the core standards for workers. And those two parts of the mission continue strong today. But we've really added a third mission, which is creating and supporting these worker centers around the country that we view as another way to support workers, particularly workers who are not yet able to be in unions. And so, in fact, the entire work is around trying to make conditions better for particularly low-wage workers in this country, and really doing that primarily through a faith lens.
Now, Kim, I think we've talked on Wage World before to a worker center up in Fayetteville. Are they part of your network?
Absolutely. They are doing phenomenal work.
I thought so. Yeah. So give us a sense of what workers, when you talk worker centers, what does that mean?
A worker center is a safe place for workers who are having problems in their workplace to come in, talk with others about their problems, learn about their rights in the workplace, and then collectively figure out how you can address those problems. And in fact, 86% of the workers that come into our worker centers around the country come in because they've been cheated of their wages. So in fact, wage theft has kind of become the sort of core thing that these worker centers do. But in fact, it's really not just that. It's workers who are injured on the job, workers who've been discriminated against. We're not taught as we grow up, and if you go to high school or college, you're not taught what your rights are in the workplace. And in so many
quite the opposite,
cities
in fact.
Right now. Well, that's right. That's right. In fact, I my kids went to Chicago Public Schools, and there was like a corporate day. And, like, business leaders would come in and tell them how they should, you know, try to be in junior achievement and work for corporations. And I was like, well, how come there's not, like, a union day, right?
Oh, and I can one-up you on that. My children went to public school in New Orleans, and there was a requirement that you had to take a half-semester free enterprise course that was essentially written by the Chamber of Commerce locally and statewide. So, you can't outdo the South for how much we support whatever the business community wants. But so a lot of people think worker centers, they think immigrant rights and that these are just for immigrants. But this is a much broader program that the worker centers that are in your network are involved in.
Now, in fact, there are lots of immigrants, and we do try to, in most of the centers, have some language capacity, so if people aren't fluent English speakers, they can be involved. But this problem of people being exploited in the workplace, it is really a black problem, a white problem, an immigrant problem. It is really a broad problem. And so increasingly, the worker centers are really trying to focus on a broad range of folks. And in fact, you know, our worker center in Northwest Arkansas, again, it focuses on white workers, black workers, Spanish-speaking workers, and Marshallese workers, right? Because that's who's there in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And they do a variety of things. So initially, these centers start by, you know, just teaching workers their rights and doing a little training here and there and helping, you know, a worker comes in and they help the worker get their money back through a variety of ways. But then as the centers stay around, they tend to do much more organizing kinds of things. So they'll say, oh, well, we've had, you know, in Northwest Arkansas, oh, we've had 50 workers come in from poultry plants. Oh, maybe there's a broad problem in the poultry industry.
Hello.
We have a whole campaign to try to improve conditions in those workplaces. And a number of the worker centers are also building, like, health and safety committees in workplaces. You know, this is the kind of thing unions used to do in many places. But, again, where you have 10% or less than 10% of private sector workers in unions.
Somebody has to do it.
That's right. Somebody's got to do it. And so these worker centers, they're actually an awful lot like the Catholic labor schools or the Jewish labor lyceums that existed from the 1930s to the 1950s, where kind of in the basement of the church or the basement of the synagogue, you taught workers what their rights were and how to organize, and that was kind of what people did as part of being a faithful person, that you have to have dignity in the workplace as well as dignity at home. So, again, I think these worker centers really are not that, they're part of our historical tradition in this country. And so there's more than 200 of them around the country. Like 10 years ago, there were a handful, and now there's 200. I think it's really a function of the crisis in the country and the crisis of workers and local communities trying to figure out what can we do to try to protect and stand with workers.
Well, and wage theft. Let's talk about wage theft, because I know you've written a book about this, and this has been a huge, I'm not going to say all-absorbing, because I know you're involved in dozens of things, but this has been a huge campaign that really IWJ has been right at the forefront on. So let's talk about wage theft, because let me tell you, 100,000 watts, there are a lot of people listening to KBF, and a lot of people have experienced wage theft, whether they know what to call that or not. So give us a sense of what the most prevalent pickpocketing of employers to workers you've found.
Well, probably the most prevalent way that workers are cheated of their wages is by not paying workers overtime wages. And that happens in a variety of ways. First, there's the employers who call people salaried folks and, oh, we're just going to pay you a flat salary, when really they shouldn't be salaried people. They really, they're not really management or, highly technical professional staff that are exempt from overtime. So it's really exempting people from overtime when they should be paid overtime. So that's very common. Then there's, the employers that, clearly know, like dishwashers are often paid like, they work 60 hours a week and they're given cash of $200. Well, obviously they're cheating them of both minimum wage and overtime, right? That's common.
And Social Security and unemployment and everything.
Well, everything else, right. Well, we'll come back to that in a second. But
okay.
There's a number of sort of middle class workers where their employers say, you can only work 40 hours, right, because I know you're not, you're covered by overtime, and I don't want to pay it. So you can only work 40 hours, and if you don't get your job done in 40 hours, I'll fire you. And so whole groups of workers will be working 45, 50 hours a week and putting down on their checks that they, or on their little timesheets, they only work 40 hours. So again, it's like their managers really know what's going on. So the biggest dollar amounts are probably stolen by not paying accurate overtime. And again, one of the ways that this occurs is what you were just referring to, Wade, which is really this misclassification, or what I call payroll fraud, where employers lie about actually having workers and they call them independent contractors. Now, some in the business world would like to pretend like this is a really complicated issue. It is not complicated. If you get up in the morning, you look in the mirror, and you say, oh, I'm going to work for myself, you're probably an independent contractor. If you get up in the morning and you say, oh, I have to go work for Joe Blow, you are an employee, no matter what they call you. And increasingly, employers call people independent contractors. Workers will come in for an interview, and they will say, we're going to pay you as an independent contractor. Sign here and say you are. me, if your employer tells you you're an independent contractor,
right,
you probably are not. I mean, again, and this is so prevalent in the society right now.
Oh, we found hotel workers in organizing drives who were housekeepers wearing the uniform of the company, whatever, and all of a sudden will, you know, file for an election at the LRB, and the company will say, oh, no, these were all independent contractors. You know, it's just, it's everywhere.
Yeah,
there's no low-wage industry that isn't doing this kind of trick.
Yeah, it's so awful. And what happens is, you know, it just becomes kind of the norm. And employers get this idea that I can just call people whatever I want. I mean, the pastor of my church calls me one day and says, oh, you know, I want to hire somebody to help with some administrative work, and I'm going to call her an independent contractor so I don't have to pay taxes. I'm like, excuse me?
Well, let me tell you, that's one person that called the wrong person. If he was asking you to bless that, he was in some trouble.
I mean, obviously that didn't happen. But again, we've had local affiliates that fight for workers' rights. We've had the board say to us, oh, well, you know, we're only one-person shop, and it's just so much trouble to figure out those taxes, and so we're going to pay them as an independent contractor. Really? I mean, so again, it comes this notion in the society that, you know, there are these various options of how you pay people, and that it is the employer's choice. That is not true. But again, it's pretty pervasive. So again, the two most common problems right now that in fact steal the biggest number of dollars are not paying overtime and the payroll fraud, the misclassification. And again, they're very related. But there's a bunch of other ways, right? So there's not paying minimum wage. There's for tipped workers. There's,
oh mercy, tipped workers. That's a whole pile of snakes, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the classic is, so my niece comes to live with me last summer. She speaks Thai, so I say to my son, drive her around to the Thai restaurants and see if she could find a job. Because, you know, she's a teenager, and we've got like 40% unemployed teenagers in the city, so I'm like trying to do everything I can. So anyway, she gets a job at my formerly favorite Thai restaurant. And
I can already see where the story is going. Okay.
Yeah, of course you can. She comes home day one, and I say, okay, Elisa, how are you being paid? And she says, oh, I get half the tip jar. There's two wait staff most shifts. And if there's three, she gets a third of it. I get half the tip jar. And I said, okay, so you get the tipped minimum wage and half the tips? She says, no, I get half the tip jar. I mean, so
wow.
The employer was not even paying the tip minimum wage, which, you know,
is ridiculous already.
It's you know, $2.65 or whatever nationally and $4.65 in Chicago. But again, so it's a ridiculous amount. But he wasn't even paying that. He's only paying the tips. I was like, and anyway, she was like, oh, but he's such a nice guy. No, he's not a nice guy. Like, he's not a nice guy. And so my niece, you know, she's a college kid. She's trying to work all summer to, you know,
sure,
college. In the course of the summer, she should have been paid $2,800, and she was paid $1,800. So he tried to steal $1,000 from her, right?
And when you say tried, did he succeed?
Of course not, because Aunt Kim went with her the last day and insisted that he pay her. And the guy looked at me and said, but this is how everybody does it.
Well, and unfortunately, he may have been telling you the truth, which is why the burden on organizations like Interfaith Workers Justice are so huge. We're talking to Kim Bobo today from Chicago, who's the executive director of Interfaith Worker Justice, which over the last 18 years has been a leader in trying to make sure workers' rights for particularly lower income, lower wage workers are respected and adhered to. So, Kim, I got to ask you, DOL, Wage and Hour Division, President Obama the last 6 years, I kept hoping they would try to make you commissioner on this, but have you gotten better cooperation? Or you see any hope for us?
Well, I think the people in leadership at the Department of Labor, at really all the levels, but in particularly at Wage and Hour, I mean, they're as good as they get. They're really wonderful people. They're trying to be strategic. They're focused. They're, you know, they really have a passion and commitment. But they only have 1,000 enforcement staff to protect 135 million workers in the country. I mean, you know, what do we have in Chicago? 10,000 police officers, right? I mean, like 1,000 enforcement staff for the entire country for 135 million workers. You know, it's just, it's a ridiculously low level of enforcement. And again, it doesn't matter how good you are, you can't enforce the law without more cops on the job, honestly. And so, again, I think that's continues to be the huge problem. Now, you may say, well, Kim, aren't there like lots of enforcement staff at the state level that can supplement that? Well, collectively in the entire country, there's about 500 additional state enforcement staff, and more than half of them are in five states, right? California, New York. You know, and there are states where, like Florida voted out their Department of Labor. They voted it out. So they have none. And then when our local affiliate in Miami led a campaign to create a local enforcement office, folks at the state legislature tried to preempt the local counties from creating such agencies, claiming it was a state issue, a state function they were trying to do, after they had voted out the Department of Labor. So again, the state enforcement in most states, again, there's some significant exceptions, California, New York, Illinois, there's some states that are really doing a fabulous job. But most states, the state enforcement is almost worthless.
And with 29 states now going to have legislatures completely controlled by the Republicans and all their crying against the minimum wage, it could get worse, couldn't it?
Well, it could. You know, I think one of the challenges for us is, you know, not only do we have to demonstrate how awful this is for workers and we need to stop the thievery, I think we've also got to continue to make the argument, which is a real one, that wage theft unabated really undermines good employers, right? That there is a very strong leveling the playing field argument. And in every place around the country where we have won local wage theft bills, which is quite a few actually, one of the ways we win is by getting business leaders to help argue the case for us, right? So like in Houston, where we won our affiliate, Faye Justicia, won a really good wage theft bill. You know, they had a guy, Stan Merrick, who runs something called Merrick Construction, who, you know, was a strong advocate saying, you know, I run a construction business. I'm trying to pay people fairly, and I'm regularly
How do I compete with the rats? Exactly.
That's right. I can't compete with these guys. And again, I think we've got to have more Stan Merricks that we can build relationships with and help them argue the leveling the playing field piece. You know, it's just a really important argument. And again, that argument is very effective with Republican legislators. And so again, if we're going to keep moving, I think that's a piece that we've got to lift up. And in fact, you know, one of the things I've been doing the last year or so is trying to figure out, is there more we could do in lifting up ethical employers, right? I've spent a lot of my life beating up on the bad guys, and we're going to continue to do that. But I do think we've got to figure out who are those ethical employers and how do we lift them up and how do we get them speaking about these issues. And, you know, there's some potential allies out there, not just for stopping wage theft, but also for increasing the minimum wage and you know, some of the and paid sick days and some of the other things we care about.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the prospects of more faith-based support. You know, you would think in an area like Arkansas or Louisiana here in the South that where people, you know, profess to be more religious on surveys and whatever, Are we getting that kind of leadership and support on these kinds of issues for low-wage workers and others from our faith community across the country, or is this something that is more California, Chicago, New York?
No, I mean, there's a lot of interest in the broad faith community on these issues. And I think one of the challenges that, you know, we all face is we see that concern for poor people expressed in very private kind of ways and in very social service kind of ways, right? So there is no shortage of religious support for soup kitchens and shelters and all that kind of stuff, which, again, some people sort of are cynical about that. I think what it shows is that people do really care about these issues of poverty. But I think a lot of people are, you know, they're just confused about how we can be the most effective in addressing some of these problems. And their confusion is not of their own doing often. In fact, there's a fairly new religious study guide that's come out called Seek Social Justice that's put out by the Heritage Foundation, right?
Which is obviously very conservative normally.
That's right. And it's a very sophisticated sort of congregational-based study guide trying to make the argument that if you really want to help poor people, the best way to do it is to give to your local church and church's local social service ministries and cut taxes on rich people, because then rich people will have more money to give to our local social service things, right?
Takes your breath away, doesn't it?
It does take your breath away. But again, this is widely distributed in evangelical communities, right? And somebody's paid big bucks to be able to get this out there. And so I think there is some confusion among people, because there is a deep concern in faith communities about poverty and about inequality and about sort of the consumerism overall in the society and, you know, in terms of particularly wealth people and the conspicuous consumption stuff. I mean, there is deep community in every single, whether, you know, Muslims or Jews or Catholics or Protestants, evangelicals, everybody is concerned about that. You know, the challenge comes like when you start moving into more structural kind of changes, into social action kind of things, anything that involves kind of controversy, you know, the faith communities often shy away from controversial kinds of matters in the economic arena.
And these aren't the 60s and 70s anymore, are they?
No. So again, I think it's an organizing challenge, right? How do we reach people, talk with people, engage people in stuff? And what I've found is when we go out to congregations and we don't talk in theory, we talk about workers and we have workers telling their story. You know, people, you know, there is a widespread, as you know, there's a whole bunch of people who don't like unions, right? Even if they have no experience with unions, right? They've kind of...
it's an ideological point that's gained a lot of traction.
Yeah, that's right. And so you find that certainly in the religious community a lot. And yet, when you take a worker to a congregation, he or she explains what's going on and why they're trying to organize, usually because they've been treated disrespectfully, and, you know, they're, you know, not treated like human beings, and so they decide to organize. Congregations support those workers. They'll say things to me like, well, you know, Kim, I don't really support unions, but these workers, they really need a union. Okay, good, right? I mean, again, it becomes personal and not just this broad ideology.
That's exactly right.
Now we're getting a huge traction on, you know, folks standing up with Walmart workers. And, almost everybody in the religious community, even if they shop at Walmart, right, people get that this is a company that is taking enormous profits really by stealing and not treating its workers fairly. And so this Black Friday, we will, across the country, there will be about 1,500 actions at local Walmart stores. and Interfaith Worker Justice and faith communities are going to do about 300 of those.
Well, there you go. This is Walmart country you're broadcasting to, and you know, so let's spread the word for sure. We ought to do another one before that.
I mean, this is, you know, people get that, you know, Walmart could do better, right? Walmart could be a leader in how you pay people, and they choose not to. And people of faith are going to be doing prayer vigils outside Walmart stores on Black Friday, right? So, again, I think that, I did a little call with a bunch of folks the other day, you know, and these were almost all church or synagogue folks who'd never done an action before. And, you know, they're asking questions like, well, will the police come? And what do we do? And, you know, but people get that how Walmart is treating people is not the way we want to go in this country. And so they're willing to come out on Black Friday and do a prayer vigil outside a Walmart store.
There you go. And believe me, you know, when we were organizing Walmart workers in Florida, the wages that Walmart claims are the average wages are, we were able to conclusively prove they were dollars less than what's real. Look, there's so many things we could talk about. I want you to do 2 minutes, though, or a minute at least, before we close, about your pay stub campaign. That looks like something that might make a difference for people.
Well, absolutely. We think that one of the simplest things that the Department of Labor could do is to do a regulation requiring employers to give a clear pay stub to workers. Right now, employers are required to keep the information, but they're not required to give it to workers. And we think if they did give it to workers, one, they would think twice before they stole wages, right, if they're going to have to put it down on paper. Secondly, it would allow workers to identify what the problems were. And third, if they went to complain with a government agency or with a lawyer, they would have good documentation. So we think issuing a clear pay stub regulation, pay stubs for all, is the simplest thing, one of the simplest things the Department of Labor could do. And honestly, you know, good employers already pay clear pay stubs. So it really is targeted at the really sleazeballs who are out there. So we
exactly. And Kim, how can people support that campaign and give people some information on how they can support you and the great work you all do in our last minute?
Well, go to IWJ.org, www.IWJ.org. At our website, you can sign up to do a Walmart action on Black Friday. You can send a letter to Tom Perez about pay stubs for all, and you can contribute money to the work. All of that is incredibly helpful. And there are dozens and dozens of congregational resources on engaging people of faith in these labor issues. So go to IWJ.org.
And the other thing that's on your website, of course, is where the nearest worker center might be close to you. We're organizing citizen wealth centers in Little Rock, Dallas, and Houston. We may have to look and see if we can join your network. We've been talking to Kim Bobo, the dynamic director of the Interfaith Worker Justice for the last 18 years. She claims she may not be doing this forever, but whatever she does, we're going to have to follow because it helps workers. This has been Wade's World, KABF 88.3 FM on your dial, the voice of the people. Wishing you another good Friday. Next Friday, we'll be back at you again, and this time we're going to be talking to a community organizer and leader in South Africa about 20 years after apartheid and what's happening in the townships. Thank you. Wade's World. Goodbye.